then I'm in the gauntlet. But this time, I'm not trying to sneak past unseen. My head is high and my shoulders are set. Solo looks up as if he intends to say something to Vickers, but when he sees me, his eyes go wide and he shakes his head. Sierra notices and turns to look in my direction. When she recognizes me, she smiles and says something to the group that I can't hear. Ignoring them, I walk up to the table and face Solo, but before I can address him, Vickers interrupts. "Hey, Solo, it's your boyfriend!" He looks me up and down. "Oh, sorry, girlfriend?" Vickers and Cole laugh, and Sierra leans toward me. "Seriously, it's hard to tell," she says. "Are you, like, an effeminate dude or just an ugly chick?" More laughter. I feel my face turning red. Vickers says, "What she's trying to ask is, are you a dyke or are you a faggot?" With heat rising in my cheeks, I ignore him and turn to Solo. "Can I talk to you for a minute?" But Solo is frozen, glaring at Vickers. "That's not really it, babe," Sierra says to Vickers, her voice dripping with artificial sweetness. "What I want to know is," she turns toward me, gestures at my crotch, "is there, like, a dick in there or a vag?" "Oh, damn," Vickers says. Cole snorts. It takes me a moment to react. I'm honestly surprised. It's one thing to whisper about me to her friends or to laugh when her boyfriend taunts me, but I didn't expect Sierra to be openly aggressive. Slowly, I turn and look her in the eye. "That's none of your business," I say. "And while I'm flattered by your interest, you're not really my type." The red-headed kid howls with laughter and claps his hands. Vickers smacks him on the arm and he shuts up. Sierra's face is white with rage. I feel a rush of triumph, but underneath it my adrenaline is surging. Then, slowly, Vickers stands and the group goes quiet. "You want to repeat what you just said to my girlfriend, faggot?" The blood drains from my face. I take a step backward. And then Solo is on his feet, his imposing frame towering over the table. He reaches a massive hand and claps Vickers on the shoulder. "Sit down, bro," he says. "You're being an ass." Cole's eyes widen in surprise, and the redheaded kid shrinks back in his seat. Vickers glares at Solo, and for a moment I think he's going to hit him. But after a few seconds, Sierra reaches up and touches Vickers' arm, and he shakes his head and sits down. Solo blinks, grabs his backpack, and starts up the aisle without further hesitation. He doesn't say a word as I follow him through the outdoor hallway and around the back of the auditorium. I think he'll turn left and head toward the ramp, but instead he plunges down the slope toward the parking lot, and I hurry after him. His car is an ancient, peeling silver Toyota hatchback. The back window is plastered to the point of opacity with decals. Featuring prominently among them are a vintage K-Rock FM bumper sticker and a Rebel Alliance logo. "Lift up the door when you open it or it'll fall off," he says. "Where are we going?" I ask. "We're ditching." Chapter 11. 10 minutes later, we're speeding down the freeway, Solo's hatchback shuddering like a porta potty in a 5.0 magnitude earthquake. "Where are we going?" I yell. Yelling is necessary because the radiator in Solo's car is shot, so he keeps the heater on full blast to prevent the car from overheating, which means all four windows have to be rolled down or else the car becomes a pizza oven. He replies, but I think I mishear him because it sounds like he says the Reagan years. But then we get off the freeway in downtown Fullerton, and sure enough, there it is, lodged between a tiny sushi restaurant and a hair salon. The Reagan years. Solo pushes open the door, and we step inside. It's an authentic 80s video arcade, packed wall to wall with old-school stand-up games like Galaga and Dig Dug and Donkey Kong. An old Oingo Boingo song blares from tinny speakers, and two square TVs mounted overhead show crackly, low-resolution MTV videos. "This place is awesome," I say. "Wait till you see the back." We walk around a big partition, and there's a full-blown 50s soda fountain, complete with checkered linoleum flooring and red vinyl bar stools. The guy behind the counter is even wearing one of those little paper hats. "When I get pissed," Solo says, "I play Miss Pac-Man." He produces a roll of quarters from his backpack, and I follow him to one of the sit-down table games. He squeezes into a tiny chair, plugs two quarters into the machine, and starts to play, yanking on the joystick as though his physical strength might somehow make the cheesy 8-bit graphics move faster. I watch him play for a while, noticing the way he presses his lips together like a trumpet player when he concentrates. It's kind of adorable. I'll get drinks, I say. Chocolate malted, he replies without looking up. Something about the way he says it, even though we haven't begun to work things out yet, gives me a sense of relief, as though it's already understood that we're going to move past this and be friends. He's not paying attention to me, but I smile at him anyway. Coming right up. When I return with the drink, Solo is just finishing a game. He stands, pumps a fist, and extends both middle fingers to the screen. Eat that, machine! He yells. I ain't afraid of no ghosts! I set his malted on the game table and unscrew the cap on my water bottle. You don't like malted? Solo says, leaning over to take a long drink from his straw. For a moment, I consider launching into the whole vegan thing, but just the thought of it exhausts me, so I shake my head instead. Solo shrugs. More for me. Did you order fries? I nod. Can I ask you a question? Shoot. Do you really think I walk around acting like I'm better than everyone else? Solo takes another long pull on his malted. I think you assume everyone is going to be your enemy, and by doing that, you sort of make it come true. So you think I made Jim Vickers call me dyke and faggot? Solo shakes his head. No, of course you didn't make him. You maybe invited him to. Invited him to? Please tell me how I invited someone to attack and humiliate me in front of the entire cafeteria. See, this is what I'm talking about. What? I met you 4 days ago. Today I abandoned my teammates of 3 years to ditch school and take you to the largest 50s soda fountain / 80s video arcade in the Western Hemisphere. But are you grateful? No, you want to fight with me. I glare at him. You invite it, he says, because you dress in a way that makes it nearly impossible for people to tell if you're a boy or a girl. It's none of their business, I reply. Solo sighs, then leans across the table. How much do you think I weigh? What? How much do you think I weigh? I shake my head. I have no idea. Look me in the eye and tell me you haven't guessed a number. I hold his gaze but say nothing. I'll bet it was the first thing you thought about when you saw me, maybe the second after trying to figure out what race I am. I look down. Solo sits back. I can't dress like a skinny person, he says. Or a white person. I am what I am, and people are going to react. That's different, I say. I'm sure it is, Solo says, but the point is, if I walked around waiting for people to call me fat boy so that I could get into a fight about it, I'd always be in a fight. He leans over and finishes his malted with one final slurp, then pushes the glass away. I look at him. He smiles, and his enormous cheeks sort of fold up and hide his ears. People really messed with you your first week, I ask? Yeah, Solo says. But you're huge. You'd think they'd know better. Solo throws up his hands. Right? What did they say? The usual. Remarks about my weight. Wetback jokes. Long swim from Samoa, I say. Solo wags his finger at me. Nothing pisses me off more than an improperly applied racial epithet. Know your minorities, people. They should make a pamphlet. I laugh. Solo says, my first day in PE, Coach Terrence pulled me aside and asked if I was interested in being on the offensive line. I didn't know what the hell he was talking about. Then he asked me if I liked video games. I thought he was making fun of me, but when I said yes, he told me to go buy Madden NFL and play it for a week. The football coach told you to buy a video game? Crazy, right? But I did, and I totally fell in love with football. What is there to love about football? Well, it's like... He begins sheepishly. You've read Harry Potter, right? 7 times all the way through. Okay, well, I'm sitting there playing Madden on my PlayStation, and it occurs to me that football is basically wizard's chess. I cock my head. You call your play, you line up your guys, and you let them fight. That's a down. Sometimes you gain ground, sometimes you lose it. It's not just a bunch of sweaty jocks out there banging into each other. You have to know your opponent. You have to think 10 moves ahead. The guy from the counter shows up with our fries. Enjoy, he says, and then walks off. I reach for a fry, and Solo continues. Anyway, when I came back the next week, Coach asked me what I thought about Madden, and I just started jabbering at him, telling him what I liked about the game. You should have seen the smile on his face. You'd have thought he just won the lottery. So you joined the team. Solo shakes his head, frowning. When he replies, his voice is low and flat. What I did was go to the gym every day for 2 weeks and eat nothing but baked potatoes and boiled chicken breasts. Then I went to the tryouts and practically got laughed off the field. They laughed at you, and you still wanted to join the team? They knew me as the 300-pound brown kid with the furry Chewbacca backpack. I didn't fit in yet. I hadn't passed the test. He reaches for a handful of fries. And yes, I did still want to join the team. I wanted to play. So what happened at tryouts? He answers with his mouth full. I tackled Vickers in the first drill, laid him out flat. Was he pissed? Solo shakes his head, swallows. Nope, he was impressed. Grudgingly, but still. That's how I earned my way in, by proving myself on the field. He looks at me. That, and I had to lose the Chewbacca backpack. You did not. He shrugs. It took a long time to lose the nickname Chewy, but eventually I became Solo. I like that a lot better. Wow, I say. So you gave up something you really love just to fit in with a bunch of guys who laughed at you and called you fat. Solo folds his arms. I didn't stop liking Star Wars or even talking about it. I just stopped wearing the furry backpack to school. You'd have done the same thing. I look at Solo, then down at my lap. I think this is where the analogy breaks down for me. Explain. I can't just stop wearing a backpack. Solo raises his eyebrows. Care to elaborate? I open my mouth, then shut it. Is this the person I want to come out to? And if he is, what will I say? Solo leans in. Look, I don't expect you to spill your guts to me. Your business is your business. Dress how you want to dress. Let people wonder. Fuck 'em. I smile. Solo raises a finger. But you've got to stop looking for a fight every time someone makes a comment. High school sucks for everyone. I feel my smile fade, and I sit back in the chair. It kind of feels like you're defending those guys. Solo shrugs. There will always be guys like Jim Vickers, but I'm not going to let them stop me from doing what I want, and neither should you. Chapter 12. We pull off the freeway and the wind rushing past the windows fades to a gentle breeze. It's the first cool evening of the fall and the air on my face is exhilarating. It feels good to be driving on a Friday night with the windows down after ditching school for video games and French fries. And I look over at Solo and feel a sudden rush of affection for him. Thanks for standing up for me today, I say. He nods. You needed it. So, I glance out the window, then back at Solo. What happens on Monday? We turn onto my street. You could come sit with us, he says. And get verbally abused by the entire football team? No thanks. I expect him to reply, maybe even get defensive, but he just pulls up in front of my house and sets the parking brake. And then we're quiet for a while, listening to the irregular idle of the old car. Are you going to get it for ditching? Solo asks. Probably. You? He shrugs. Half the time my mom yells at me. I can't understand what she's saying. Plus, I have a really good shame face. He tilts his head toward me and his massive cheeks fall forward. He looks like an enormous, sad bulldog. That is a really good shame face. I glance out the window at my house. If the attendance office called my parents, I'm probably in for a talk when they get home. In the meantime, I feel good. Maybe for the first time since I started at Park Hills. After a moment, I get out of the car. Have a good weekend, I say, closing the rickety door. Solo bows. May the force be with you. My parents won't be home for another hour and a half, so I sequester myself in my room, fire up my laptop, and log into Blogler. When my dash appears, I lean back in my chair and stare at the numbers on the screen. Messages, 27. Followers, 568. 568 followers? Last time I checked, it was 50-something, and it's been less than a week. I click refresh, but the numbers remain the same. How did I gain so many followers so quickly? I start clicking on their avatars and browsing through their profiles, paying particular attention to the connections we have in common. When I notice that the first dozen or so also follow Queer Alliance's Blogler feed, things start to make sense. Queer Alliance is a popular site. It probably gets thousands of hits every day. All these people must have found me because I was featured in the What's New section on the homepage. I run my fingers through my hair. These 500 new followers, these strangers, have read my most personal thoughts, my most embarrassing feelings, my secrets. All at once, I feel naked. I know it's practically impossible, but what if someone reads this and knows it's me? I glance at the window to make sure my curtains are closed. They are. Then a nervous laugh escapes me and I shake my head. I'm just being paranoid. Blogler is anonymous. There's nothing anyone could use to connect Alex the blogger with Riley the congressman's kid. I let out a long breath and then I scroll through the comments. People appear to actually like what I've shared. More than that, they seem to take comfort or inspiration from it, and that makes me feel, I don't know, like I matter? Like maybe I'm not so alone after all. I click on messages and start reading. Anonymous. Love your blog. Yellow bedwetter. More, please. Anonymous. OMG. Thank you so much. I came out to my mom over the weekend and she cried and couldn't understand, kept asking if I was trans and I couldn't explain. After I read your post, I told her your line. It's not a switch, it's a dial. I think she finally got it. You have no idea. Thank you. Mimi Q. Oh, Alex, I don't envy where you are, but you will make it. You are an inspiration. Keep writing. I scroll down. There are more messages like the ones above. I start replying, thanking the senders, and welcoming my new followers. And then, after about 20 minutes, I come to a more substantial message, and I start to read. Anonymous. Hi, Alex. I totally started crying when I read your story about being in the toy store with your dad. That is what I've been feeling my whole life, exactly that. Anyway, thank you so much. I want to come out to my sister, but I don't know what to say. Any advice? I reread the message. My heart physically aches at the thought that something I wrote helped this stranger figure out what they're going through. I start to type out a reply, tentatively at first, but with increasing velocity. Soon my hands are flying over the keyboard. I'm surprised how much I have to say. And then, just as I'm about to click post, I hesitate. Because the message is anonymous, I can't reply privately. Anyone who follows my blog will be able to see this. I reread what I've written. It all sounds wrong. False. Arrogant. Who am I to give this person advice? For one thing, I don't know anything about coming out. I'm still in the closet myself. How am I remotely qualified to advise this stranger on something so big? I delete my reply and type a new one. Alex. Hi, Anonymous. I wish I could give you advice, but the truth is I'm just a big fat coward. The only person I've come out to is my therapist, who is oath-bound not to judge me and required by law to keep my secrets. In my own searching, I've come across a couple sites that might help. Try blogler.com/genderbender and also queeralliance.org. Sorry, I couldn't be more helpful. I reread my response, consider deleting it again, and then finally click post. I sit back in my chair and frown at the screen. I feel unsatisfied, like I just brushed someone off. I find myself second-guessing myself, wishing I had shared my original response after all. My thoughts are interrupted by the sound of the garage door. My parents are home. They're waiting for me in the living room when I come downstairs. My mother is stationed on the long sofa, her face tight with worry, her arms and legs crossed as though she's trying to tie her whole body in a knot. Dad paces in front of the coffee table, stopping when I enter. Riley, he says, we need to talk to you. Sit down. His voice is even, but I can tell by the set of his jaw that he's really angry. I approach and sit in a chair facing them. We got a call from school, Dad says. They said you weren't in class after lunch. I nod. You want to tell us where you were?
I ditched with a friend. We went to Fullerton. Were you drinking? My mother asks.
What? No, I had water. We were just talking. Dad moves toward me. Let me smell your breath. And just like that, we backslide. The trust I've worked so hard to rebuild over the last month is gone in one afternoon. And the stupid part is, I was never even into drinking. It was just that one time. The time. But even after 6 weeks in Pineview, they've never forgiven me, and they've never forgotten. Dad leans forward, and I exhale in his face. He nods, satisfied, and moves to sit next to my mother. I'm sorry, I say. I know I shouldn't have ditched, but I needed to get out of there. We're going to need more of an explanation than that, Dad says. I look down at my lap. I was having a bad day.
Dad exhales through his nose. You can't walk out of school just because you're having a bad day. You have to... But Mom lays a hand on his knee to cut him off. Tell us what happened, honey. I think about Vickers demanding to know whether I was a dyke or a faggot, but I can't tell them that. So I say, some kids were making fun of me. Dad throws up his hands. And? His face is the color of beets, and I feel myself shrink from him. At my reaction, he folds his hands and softens his voice. Riley, listen. Words can hurt. I get it. Jesus, right now there are consultants being paid thousands of dollars to write bad things about me, but you can't just walk out. You have to keep your chin up. I feel tears stinging my eyes and I clench my jaw. I don't want to cry. I don't want to break down in front of them. What did they say to you? Mom asks. I shift in my seat. I have to tell them something. They were making fun of the way I dress. Dad shakes his head and looks up at the ceiling. Mom reaches out to put a hand on his knee again, then thinks better of it and folds her hands in her lap. We're just concerned, she says. You spend all your time shut up in your room on your computer, and she looks me up and down, and I just know she's about to make a comment about my clothes. When you were at Immaculate Heart, we thought... She glances at Dad. I mean, we thought you were just rebelling against all that structure, the uniform and the strict rules and everything. But now we don't know what it is, Dad says. I hear Dr. Ann's voice in my head telling me to take a slow, deep breath. I try, but I find that I can't. My chest is too tight. My fingertips are beginning to tingle. Mom picks nervously at her cuticles. You know, she says, not having a uniform can be really liberating. It's a great opportunity to wear what you want, to stand out from the crowd. I want to scream. That's exactly what I don't want to do. Dad gets up, thrusts his hands into his pockets, and starts pacing again. We're not dinosaurs, Riley. We remember what high school is like. He has no idea what it's like. And I know you think this is superficial, he says, but the fact is, appearance matters. People do judge books by their covers. It's human nature. They react to the way you look before they hear a single word that comes out of your mouth. I don't respond. The tingling spreads to my face. If you don't like the outfits I bought you, Mom says, we could go shopping together. We could make a day out of it. She smiles, but it withers when she sees the look on my face. You think I wouldn't rather lounge around in sweats all day? Dad says. Believe me, I would. But you have to dress for the life you want. Is this how you want to live? He stops, pulls a hand out of his pocket, and makes a dismissive gesture at me. Is this who you are? My vision starts to tunnel. I grip the arm of the chair and stand. I need to go lie down, I say. My voice sounds distant. We're not through talking. I can't talk about this. You can and you will. Riley, Mom begins, but now it's Dad who interrupts. Let me handle this, Sharon. He turns toward me. Don't pretend we're the bad guys here. You want to dress this way, fine. But don't use other people's reactions as an excuse to walk out on your obligations. He holds up a finger. First, you cancel last minute on a very important fundraiser. And we supported you because we want you to have friends. We really do. But the very next day you turn around and ditch class? Please stop, I say. Sean, Mom says, but Dad cuts her off. I'm trying to run a very public campaign about education reform. You don't think the media will hear about it if my kid starts racking up truancies? How do you think this reflects on me? And then it's as though a dam breaks in my head, and the tingling floods through me. I feel like I'm in someone else's body. My father is still talking, gesturing emphatically, but his voice and his movements seem far away. Stop, I say, covering my ears with my tingling hands, holding my head so it doesn't fall apart. My voice sounds like it's coming from someone else, someone talking in another room. Stop talking, I say more loudly. Just please shut up. Do not speak to me. Shut up, I scream. Mom's face goes white. My father's mouth falls open, and suddenly he looks like a little boy. I can't stand to look at him. I feel my body turn and move toward the stairs. And then I'm in my room, and I feel my comforter on my face, and the tingling is everywhere. I bury my face in the pillow, and I scream. And I scream. When I come back to myself, I'm lying on my side in bed, facing the wall. I can hear my parents talking softly behind me. I start to roll over. Mom senses me moving and lifts the cold cloth from my neck. "It's okay, honey," she says. I blink up at her. Dad moves to stand in the doorway. "You have your regular appointment with Dr. Ann tomorrow." He's still angry, but the heat is gone from his voice. "In the meantime, you're grounded." He holds up my laptop. I want to yell and punch the wall. I want to scream again and say I'm sorry and cry and push my mother away. I want to do all these things, but instead I roll over and press my face into the comforter. After a moment, I hear the door close. Chapter 13. There isn't even a couch in Dr. Ann's office, just a big Pottery Barn desk and two ugly leather armchairs that always make me feel like I'm sitting on a dead cow. Dr. Ann sits across from me wearing a blue dress, one leg crossed elegantly over the other. She doesn't use a notebook or anything during our sessions, which somehow makes me feel even more scrutinized, because her eyes never leave me. But all I can think about as I stare at the pale green wallpaper is my dad's blank look when I screamed at him to shut up and my mother shrinking into the couch. "What's going on over there?" Dr. Ann asks. "Are you replaying the confrontation from last night?" I stare at her. "How'd you know?" Dr. Ann nods toward the wall of diplomas behind her desk. "I have very expensive degrees," she says. I laugh, then run a hand through my hair. I didn't mean to yell at them. It was like someone else was using my mouth to do the yelling. She nods. My face was doing the tingling thing and I couldn't breathe. "Has that been happening a lot?" "I guess. I mean, it's been worse since I started school." "Are you taking your meds?" I scrub at the carpet with one foot. "Yeah, Dad's doling them out." Dr. Ann steeples her hands and touches her two index fingers to her lips. "Why don't you tell me something good that happened this week?"
"Something good?"
"Yes." I think for a minute and then I just start to babble. I share about meeting Solo and our subsequent fight. I describe my fluctuation episode in the hall, my panic attack the next day, and finally conquering the gauntlet. I tell her about ditching the fundraiser to study with Beck and how I thought there was sexual tension, but it was probably all in my head. I tell her about going to the Reagan years with Solo and making up. When I finally glance at the clock above the door, I've been talking for almost 30 minutes straight, so I stop. Dr. Ann watches me, waiting to see if I'll continue. I don't. "Have you thought any more about starting that journal blog I suggested?" "Oh, yeah," I say. "I almost forgot." And I fill her in on everything, from my first post to the anonymous "You're a fag" commenter to getting 500 followers in a week. "Wow," she says, and then actually laughs out loud. "Are you laughing at me?" Dr. Ann recovers, shakes her head. "No, psychiatrists aren't permitted to laugh at our patients." She smiles. "I'm glad you started the blog. I think other teenagers will benefit from your insight." I let out a breath I didn't realize I'd been holding. I guess I wanted her validation. Not just for the blog, but for the way I've been thinking and feeling. Dr. Ann glances at her watch, and I sit up straighter. "We're just getting started. I'm not ready to go yet." "We haven't talked about my dysphoria," I say.
"Would you like to talk about your dysphoria?"
"Not really."
"Okay," she says.
"Just okay?"
Dr. Ann frowns.
"I get the impression you want something from me. Do you want to tell me what it is?" I open my mouth and close it. Then I say, "I don't know, I feel like you listen, but you don't do anything to fix what's wrong with me."
"Well, okay," she says, "but I don't think there's anything wrong with you."
"Then why am I here?"
"Why do you think you're here?"
"It's really fucking annoying when you do that," I snap.
Dr. Ann exhales heavily, then nods.
"I'm sorry," I say.
"Riley, I don't know what you want me to do for you."
I lean forward. "I want you to fix my anxiety. Make me feel like it's okay to be who I am. Help me figure out how to tell my parents in a way that will make them okay with it."
Dr. Ann folds her arms.
"That's a lot."
I throw up my hands.
"All right," she says, "let's start with the anxiety. Okay. So first, I want you to know that everybody experiences some level of anxiety. It's a normal human response to stress. It's like your body's smoke alarm. If there's a fire, you want to know so you can put it out or call 911, right? I shrug. I guess, but it feels like my alarm is going off all the time. Dr. Ann nods. Some people's systems are more sensitive than others. For you, maybe all it takes is burning a piece of toast and your alarm thinks the house is on fire. I nod. But there's no doubt you're experiencing a lot of stress. You just changed schools, your dad is running for office, that's enough to give anybody a little anxiety. But when you add the bullying at school and the gender dysphoria you're experiencing, it can be overwhelming. And if we take your sensitivity into consideration, it's not surprising that you're having more frequent, intense episodes. I sit back. I hadn't thought of it like that. And she's right, it is overwhelming. So how do I cope with it, I say. You are coping. You're taking meds, you're going out with friends, standing up for yourself, writing about it, screaming at your parents. And that's normal? For a teenager in your situation, I'd say so. It's better than... She pauses as if catching herself before saying the wrong thing. Doing something extreme. I fold my arms. You mean like washing down a dozen Xanax with a bottle of whiskey? Dr. Ann's mouth drops open slightly, but then she recovers. Yes, she says. It's much better than that. She looks like she's waiting for me to say something more about it. When I don't, she leans forward in her chair and speaks again, more softly this time. As for wondering if it's okay to be who you are, that's not a symptom of mental illness. That's a symptom of being a person. What about my parents? Are you ready to tell them? No. But I'm kind of afraid I will, like in a moment of anger. Do you know what you want to say? No, hell no. All right, well, let's make an agreement. You won't tell them until we've had a chance to talk about it first. How about that? Okay, I say. And instantly I feel a weight lifted. I put my face in my hands and my shoulders start to shake. I hear Dr. Ann pull a tissue out of the box on her side table and I take it from her, blow my nose, and look up. I feel like you should give me some deep advice or something. About what? Like, I don't know, about life or how I'm supposed to deal with all this. Dr. Ann scrunches up her face in concentration. She's quiet for so long that I wonder if she's forgotten I'm there. Then, finally, she speaks. Find a cause. Find a cause? What does that mean? Take a stand for someone other than yourself. You mean, like, demonstrate for animal rights or something? I squirm on the leather chair. Dr. Ann raises an eyebrow. If that appeals to you. How will that help? Maybe it'll get you out of your head. Get you to stop thinking about you so much. Get you engaged with other people. Stop thinking about me so much? What's that supposed to mean? I want to say it out loud to snap at her, but instead I just sort of deflate in the chair. She's probably right. She usually is. But the last thing I want to do right now is engage with other people. Find a cause, that's your deep advice. She shrugs. Take it or leave it. Chapter 14. New post, rebel rebel without a cause. October 7th, 10:22 p.m. Forgive me, blogler, for I have sinned. It has been 2 whole days since my last post. Thank you for your kind messages and comments. Also, thank you to all my new followers. I know that most of you probably found me through Queer Alliance, so thanks to them for featuring me on their site. I honestly don't know what I did to deserve that, but I'll try to live up to the honor. Now playing Rebel Rebel by David Bowie. But now, dear readers, I need your help. The next phase of my therapy includes an assignment. I must find a cause. Something that will get me out of my own head, stop me from thinking about me too much. So here are my ideas in no particular order. Animal rights, vegan activism, protests and stuff. Community service, the helping old people kind, not the picking up trash in an orange vest kind. Anti-bullying club, if they have one at my school. And that's all I have. Seriously, I need your help on this, badly. Please send me ideas. Hashtag gender fluid, hashtag animal rights, hashtag vegan, hashtag anxiety, hashtag recovery. I click post, then start sorting through my inbox. Mostly I've received nice messages from new followers thanking me for sharing or inviting me to check out their blogs. There are a few negative anons, but none of them are quite as rude as "you're a fag," and I delete them quickly. The good messages outnumber the bad by at least 5-1. After about half an hour, I come to a particularly interesting but utterly inappropriate question, and I decide to issue another smackdown a la my apostrophe post. Anonymous. Okay, so sometimes you feel like a boy and sometimes you feel like a girl. How do you have sex? Alex. Well, I actually haven't had sex yet, so technically I'm not qualified to answer. And while I understand you're curious, you need to know that "how do you have sex" is a cataclysmically impolite question. Like, would you ask your cis male friend how he has sex? You. Yo, Biff, you have a penis. How do you have sex? Biff. What, you want me to describe it? You. Yes, please. Biff. Why? You. I have a nearly sociopathic disregard for both your privacy and your feelings. Biff. Wow, that's really honest. I am strangely compelled to grant your request. You. Please provide graphic anatomical detail. Visual aids would help. Perhaps a series of animated GIFs. Biff. Sounds like a lot of work. How about I just use a vulgar euphemism instead? You. Sold. Biff. Okay. The airplane lands in the hangar, and then it takes off again, and then it lands again, and then it takes off again. You. This is a terrible metaphor. It sounds like you're describing feeding a baby. Biff. I did say it would be a vulgar euphemism. You. Wow, I am filled with regret for having pursued this uncouth line of inquiry. Biff. I forgive you. Here, I have made you an elaborate stop-motion film using Play-Doh and the camera on my phone. This should explain everything. You. This is very informative. I hope you are nominated for an Oscar. Footnote. For those of you joining us from outside the LGBTQ bubble, cis, pronounced like the cis in sister, is sort of like the opposite of trans. More specifically, it means you identify as a gender you were assigned at birth. To put it crudely, cis male equals you have a penis and you feel like a boy. Cis female equals you have a vagina and you feel like a girl. Okay, that's a gross oversimplification, but it's the best I can do on short notice. Feel free to Google it. End public service announcement. I sort through a few more messages, and then, just as I'm clicking post on my final answer of the night, the envelope icon turns red again. Anonymous. Hi, Alex. I hope you answer this. I'm writing from my phone at the train station right now. I don't know where else to go. I don't even know how to start, so I'll just say it. I came out to my parents about 2 hours ago that I'm a trans girl. After I told them, my mom sort of shrank back and put a hand over her mouth and didn't say anything. My dad started yelling at me. He said I'm not his son. I told him I wish I could be his daughter instead. And then he hit me. And I left. And now I keep staring at the train tracks and thinking I should just throw myself down there. Please, reply. I let out a long, slow breath. This one is not a joke. It's serious. And I don't feel qualified to respond to something this intense, maybe even life or death, but at the same time, she reached out to me, and she's desperate. I check the timestamp. The message was sent less than 3 minutes ago. If I'm going to reply, I should do it now. But what do I even say? Hands shaking, I start typing. Alex, first off, please don't kill yourself. I can't imagine how much pain you're in, but don't, please. Go here if you want to, translifeline.org. They're way better at this than I am. I'm just a kid on the internet. I consider just clicking post, but it doesn't seem like enough. I take a deep breath. What would I want to hear? After staring at the screen for a minute, I put my fingers back on the keys and continue. I am so sorry your parents reacted that way, and I know this might not make it hurt less, but I have to say thank you for being so brave. You have so much guts to be honest like that. To say that to your dad, you're probably the bravest person I've ever heard of. If I were with you at the train station right now, I would hug you until you couldn't breathe, and then we would go to the little store and buy root beer and red vines and bite off the ends and use them as straws to drink the root beer while we waited for the train. And then we'd get on and go somewhere very, very far away, like Pennsylvania or Prague, and we would find people like us and live in an apartment and make art and sell it and have a garden on the roof and just be happy. But I know we can't do that. So I'll just keep writing until I come up with something real that might help. You have to know that there is nothing wrong with you. Your parents' reactions have zero to do with you and everything to do with them. For you, coming out is about finally understanding who you are and then admitting it to the people who are most important to you. But for your parents, maybe they see it as this big, shocking change, and they aren't equipped to handle it. To them, it's like you suddenly made this huge choice they don't understand. I know what you're thinking. It's not a choice. It's how you were born. It's who you are. You're not making some arbitrary decision to make your life and theirs more difficult. You're just finally accepting who you already are. But the thing is, you did make a choice. You chose to come out. You know what's messed up? People tolerate secrecy. I see it in my life. It's like, it's okay to have gay feelings or trans feelings or gender fluid feelings as long as you keep them inside. As long as you don't act on them. Whatever that means. People don't condemn you for being trans. They condemn you for embracing it. So, see it from your parents' point of view for a second. They're sitting there on the couch and you come downstairs and in less than 5 minutes you turn their world completely upside down. And they didn't have a chance to prepare, so all their bad and ugly feelings rise to the surface. All the worst parts of them just flood out and fill the room and drown your heart. And the thing is, they probably already wish they could take it all back. So, Anonymous, please don't throw yourself onto that track. Because this is the worst part, right here, right now. If you can just get past this part, it gets better. If you're reading this and you still have a battery and signal, go to queeralliance.org. I just checked and they have contact info for shelters and safe houses in almost every major city. There's a hotline you can call. They can help. We're with you. I click post and sit back in my chair. I'm worried that I've said the wrong things or that I'm too late and that the anonymous sender has already done something drastic. I wish I had said more. I wish I had been cleverer, more compassionate. Suddenly tired and out of things to say, I reach for the keyboard to log off. Just then, the envelope icon blinks red again. I click it. There's only one message. It reads, Anonymous. Go back where you came from, Dyke. Our school doesn't need another faggot. Chapter 15. I sit completely still and stare at the screen. It's like someone slapped me in the face. My pulse doubles. I read the message again. I don't know what to do. I look up stupidly at the closed door to my room as though my father might walk in and tell me what to do. Do I delete the message? Do I report it to someone? I sit for a moment, waiting for the shock to turn into anger, but instead a cold fear spreads through me like ice water in my veins. I sit there staring at the screen, and then I remember that low, mocking voice. What she's trying to ask is, are you a dyke or are you a faggot? Almost the exact words Jim Vickers used 2 days ago. I stand and cross to my window to make sure it's locked. It is. I sit back down at the computer. Could Vickers have found my blog? Has he somehow connected Alex from Blogler with Solo's friend from school? Does he know who I am? My heart palpitates once, twice. If Vickers knew, he could tell everyone. He could post it online, send out a mass email. Everyone would know about me. I couldn't go back to school, not after that. And then someone could connect the dots to my father, my congressman father, his campaign. It would be over. His career would be ruined. Oh, God. I run back to my computer, my heart pounding in my throat. I click settings and scroll down to delete user account. I click the link. A box pops up. Are you sure you want to delete your account? My finger hovers over the trackpad. All I have to do is click OK, and Vickers won't be able to expose me. He can tell people about me, sure, but it will be his word against mine. But if I do it, I'll be giving up the only thing that seems to relieve my anxiety. And on top of that, I'll lose my new friends, all 624 of them. I already hide from my parents, from my classmates, even from Beck and Solo. This blog is the truest part of me. If I delete it, if I erase any record of who I am, what will be left? I close my eyes, take 3 slow breaths, and click cancel. I go back to the inbox screen and open the message one more time. Go back where you came from, Dyke. Our school doesn't need another faggot. Okay. So the sender used Dyke and faggot, the same words Vickers called me in the cafeteria. But how common are those words? They get thrown around every day in and outside of school and certainly all over the internet. Hell, that first anonymous sender called me fag. There's nothing here that points specifically to Vickers. And the second line. Our school doesn't need another faggot. Not Park Hills High, but our school. Anyone could have sent this message, it's just an empty threat. Anonymous hate. My panic starts to subside. I consider replying, and then almost without deciding to, I delete the message. I close my laptop and lie back on my bed, but my mind won't shut down. I think about what Solo said about how I walk around assuming everyone is a bigoted asshole. I try to reconcile his live-and-let-live attitude with the message I just received. I can't. And then I think about the girl at the train station. About how scary it must have been to tell her parents the truth right to their faces, and how crushed she must have felt when they rejected her. To be cast out by your own parents. And I think about her now, wondering if she read my reply. Wondering whether she's still sitting on that bench, or if she's already thrown herself onto the tracks. I get very little sleep, and when I walk into school Monday morning, I'm completely exhausted. It's only my second week at Park Hills High, but it already feels like my second year. I'm feeling super guyish, so I don't really bother to put myself together this morning. I'm wearing a baggy t-shirt and the same jeans I wore all weekend. But I did take time to tease the top of my hair into a faux hawk. Solo comments on my scruffy appearance via text, and I reply with a stealthily taken phone pic of my middle finger. When Miss Crane isn't looking, Solo retaliates by bouncing a starburst off the side of my head. Beck is absent from government. Again. The lunch bell rings, and I start across the quad toward the cafeteria. I'm still a little uncertain of where I stand with Solo. Sure, he invited me to sit with him, but I think he knew I would refuse. Regardless, I've decided to let it be, for now. To pick my battles, as Mom would say. I descend the stairs and enter the gauntlet without hesitation. As I approach the football table, I brace myself for an onslaught, but it never comes. Solo gives me a curt nod as I pass, but nobody says a word to me. And then, just as I'm about to declare victory, Jim Vickers looks up and makes eye contact with me. He smiles, but it doesn't touch his eyes. All at once, the fear from last night, that somehow he knows about my blog, that he'll expose me, comes rushing back, and I look down and walk faster. Moments later, I'm through the gauntlet and standing in the lunch line. I try to clear my mind, but that cold smile seems to be burned into the backs of my eyelids. Did I see a deeper meaning behind it? An echo of the anonymous hate message from last night, or was it just my imagination? I'm disappointed but unsurprised to find the ramp empty. Beck must be traveling with her dad again. I figure I could eat here alone or see if Miss Crane is still in her room, but then I look down at my dry cafeteria burrito and decide that I'm just not that hungry. Solo is with his people, Beck is with her dad, and I'm alone, on this stupid ramp, by myself. Thinking about being alone, by myself. And for the first time I can remember, I'm actually disgusted by my own self-pity. I hear Dr. Ann's voice in my head telling me to stop thinking about me so much, to get engaged with other people, to find a cause. And she's right, I really should do something. Reluctantly, I stuff the burrito into my bag and head toward the activities office. I'm approaching the counter when the pretty blonde girl behind it looks up and says, "Bonjour, Riley." I stare at her for a minute, caught off guard by the greeting until I recognize her. It's Casey Reese, the girl who sits in front of me in French. At my lack of response, her smile fades. "Sorry," she replies, "need to work on my accent." "No," I say too quickly, "no, it's really good." Casey's smile returns at full wattage. "I love your hair," she says, absently reaching to run her fingers through her own. "How do you make it do that?" "Oh, I don't know, I just, like, brush it up, sort of, with my hand," I demonstrate. She cocks her head. "You don't use hairspray or anything?" I shrug. "My hair is naturally sticky-uppy. Plus, it's shorter than yours." She nods. I think she'll say something else, drive the conversation deeper, but she just sort of spaces out. Finally, I clear my throat. Do you have, like, a list of clubs on campus?" "Oh, sure." She retrieves a green 3-ring binder from her desk and sets it in front of me. "They're all in here. Let me know if you need anything else." She smiles again, then crosses back to her desk and starts sorting through a pile of paperwork. I stand there at the counter, flipping through club flyers and sign-up sheets. There's a Young Investor Society, an academic decathlon team, and a chapter of the Orange County Teen Republicans Network. I could join the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, if I were an athlete, and if they take deeply conflicted Catholics, but I'm really looking for something more service-oriented. Now I'm halfway through the binder, and what little hope I had is dwindling fast. There's no Animal Rights Club, no Vegan Teens Association, no Anti-Bullying Coalition. I don't really expect to find a transgender group, and when I do finally come across the Park Hills Gay-Straight Alliance, I'm unsurprised to see only two names on the sign-up sheet, both dated 3 years ago. I'm about to slam the binder shut and walk out of the office when a pink flyer catches my eye. Join PALS, Peer Academic Assistance at Lunch, Mondays in the Library. I read it twice, rolling my eyes at the cheesy name. Peer tutoring isn't exciting or political, but it does meet Dr. N's requirement of getting engaged with other people. Reluctantly, I close the binder, say au revoir to Casey, and set off for the library. I spot Sierra Wells as soon as I walk through the front door. She's sitting at one of the long tables next to the entrance, talking to a younger girl who's stuffing her books into a red backpack. I'm about to turn and walk out, but then the girl mumbles something, and Sierra replies in a surprisingly gentle tone. I know, receive still trips me up too. Just remember, it's better to give than to receive. Both words end in an I-V-E. And then her face splits into a wide, genuine smile. This hardly looks or sounds like the same sneering girl who asked if I was a dude or a chick. I pause, half turned toward the door. The younger girl stands, says goodbye to Sierra, and walks past me out the door. That's when Sierra looks up and sees me, and her smile dissolves. Oh, she says. The gentleness is gone from her tone. Here. She reaches into her book bag and extracts a small package wrapped in purple tissue paper. She holds it out to me, and I stare at it. What could she possibly want to give me? Your mom ordered these, Sierra says, thrusting the package at me. Oh, right, the essential oils, thanks, I say, taking it. Yeah, she replies, then closes her planner and starts packing up her things. She's wearing a long-sleeve sweater, but as she reaches down to put her binder away, her sleeve slides up, exposing a scab-like patch of discolored skin on her forearm. I've seen marks like this before, on one of the other patients at Pineview. His were from obsessive scratching. It was the way he dealt with stress. I wonder what Sierra's are from. I feel a sudden wave of sympathy for her, and I speak without really meaning to. I'm sorry about the other day, I say, at my house. Sierra looks up at me surprised. I'm surprised too, but I keep talking. I hate it when my parents use me like a prop. Sierra's face takes on a green tinge and she looks away. Yeah, well, she says, shouldering her bag. Whatever. She stands, pushes in her chair, and walks out. I watch her leave, feeling stupid for even trying to talk to her. After the way she treated me, what made me think I could change her mind? And why would I bother? I guess it's like Dad says, you only get one chance at a first impression. When I get home, I find a note from my mom explaining that she and Dad will be out late at some dinner event. I reheat the tofu rice dish she left me and eat it standing in the kitchen. I consider checking my blog, but decide against it. I have a bad feeling about the trans girl from last night, the one who wrote me from the train station. I'm afraid of what she might say if she replies. What if she calls me out? Like, what gives me the right to give her advice? What experience do I have that could possibly compare to what she's going through? Or worse, what if something happened and she hasn't replied at all? On Tuesday, Mr. Hibbert informs the class that we have a pre-calc test on Thursday. It's my least favorite subject and I haven't done any of the homework. The news sort of derails my day and I decide I'm definitely not up for lunch in the cafeteria from hell. I intercept Solo as he's walking out of algebra and persuade him to sneak off campus with me. Since Beck wasn't in government, I hold out little hope that she'll turn up at the ramp, but I convince Solo to walk past it on the way to the parking lot anyway. She's not there. On the way to Shaco Tacos, I pick Solo's brain for volunteering ideas. My church does a potluck soup kitchen on the first Sunday of every month, Solo says, shrugging. Or maybe you could pass out juice at the High School Football Association blood drive. I could probably get my mom to make a dish for the potluck, but that doesn't qualify as me doing something. And the thought of waiting on a room full of Solo's bleeding teammates makes me queasy. I'll have to keep looking. That night, I sit down at my desk, thinking I'll have the courage to check Blogler. But when I get to the login screen, I stop. Between Mr. Hibbard's looming test and my failed attempts to find a cause, the buzz of anxiety has been pretty much constant for the last few days, and the thought of getting another hate message like, "Go back where you came from, Dyke," amplifies it even more. The trans girl from the train station crosses my mind too, but I push the thought away. I'm already a month behind. I need to study. So I close my laptop and open my pre-calc book. On Wednesday, Beck is absent from government again, and I'm beginning to think she's not coming back. I shoot her a text, but I get no reply. Still, I'm disappointed when I find the ramp empty. I sit down anyway, and I'm just starting to unwrap my burrito when I hear a familiar voice from behind. "You're just racking up the tolls, aren't you?" Chapter 16. I turn to find Beck standing over me. She's wearing a Cura t-shirt with the neck cut out, black leggings, and a plaid skirt that gives me Catholic school flashbacks. She's been gone for nearly 3 days, and she looks like she spent the whole time at super hot goth girl makeover camp. Her expression is, as ever, unreadable behind her mirrored sunglasses. "Hi," I say. Beck smirks. "First," she says, counting off on her fingers, "there's the toll from last week. And then I actually gave you 2 juice boxes plus 1 for today. And I figure you've come looking for me every day this week. So honestly, at this point, we're way beyond Amazon gift cards and deep into narcotics territory." I hold back a smile. "What makes you so sure I came looking for you?" Beck drops her backpack and sits next to me on the ramp. She pulls her shades down and looks at me with those blue eyes. "Riley, if I were to disclose to you the full extent of my powers, the shadow government would be here within moments to whisk me away in an unmarked black helicopter. Have you ever ridden in a helicopter?"
"No," I admit.
"Well, let's just say that if I ever decide to tell you my secrets, I will need a triple dose of non-drowsy Dramamine in addition to the aforementioned narcotics."
"I see."
Beck reaches into her backpack and extracts a 3-foot-long stick of beef jerky. I grimace. I take a bite out of my bean and no-cheese burrito, and for a moment we just eat in silence. "So," I say, "were you traveling with your dad?"
"No, I was taking care of some family stuff."
"Oh, that's all I get? I want to ask where the hell she's been and why she hasn't called me since our date, if that's even what it was. And then it occurs to me, maybe she expected me to call her. All these thoughts lock up in my head, and none of them make it to my mouth. Beck extracts a juice box from her backpack. "I heard you had words with the football team." I gape at her.
"How did you know?"
"Everybody knows. You were, like, yelling in the middle of the cafeteria." "I never yelled." Beck shrugs. "Well, you made some waves." A wide grin splits her face. "People are talking about you behind your back." "Great. Not only have I failed to blend in, but I'm making waves." I swallow hard. "What are they saying?" Beck pulls off her sunglasses and considers me. "They're saying how the new kid totally owned the couple from hell in front of everyone at lunch." I smile, though I suspect she's embellishing for my benefit.
"The new kid, is that all they're calling me?"
Beck shrugs. "One person may have referred to you as that androgynous chick dude, but I slapped his hat off." My smile widens considerably. "But listen," Beck says, narrowing her eyes, "you should be careful. Jim Vickers is not a guy you want to piss off." I remember Vickers' look, and I suppress a shudder. "I'll be okay. I'm friends with someone else on the team." Beck nods. "Jason Solomona, a.k.a. Chewy, used to be one of us until Coach Terrence turned him."
"Turned him?"
Beck sighs and stuffs the half-eaten Slim Jim back into her backpack. "You can't be on the football team and still hang with the freaks and geeks. Chewy learned that a long time ago."
"Well, he's friends with me," I say.
"Then why aren't you eating with him?"
I smile. "Maybe I prefer the company of cute girls with lip rings."
And then I realize that I actually said that out loud with my actual voice, and my stomach sort of ceases to exist, leaving a large vacuum where my guts were just a moment before. But Beck seems unperturbed by the comment. She puts her shades back on and says, "What are you doing this weekend?" My guts are back, and now they're doing somersaults. "Nothing," I say. "I mean, I'm grounded."
"When does your sentence end?"
"Saturday."
"Perfect. You're coming with me to a club in L.A.